Lost Treasures of Indiana, Gone But Not Forgotten. I'm David James, and next on 2 Main Street, my conversation with author and award-winning journalist Joseph Peet. Remember Sir Beef, Burger Chef, and Grandy's? And what about Clabber Girl, Pluto Water, and the L.S. Ayres department stores? It's Hoosier Nostalgia, as we remember the familiar and the obscure, from former automakers including Studebaker and Auburn to sports teams. Remember the Fort Wayne Pistons? And did you know there's a ghost town in southern Indiana? And the site of a Revolutionary War battle along Lake Michigan. Lost Treasures of Indiana is just ahead on 2 Main Street, presented by the Berger Wren Group and Baird Private Wealth Management. From the WNIN Public Media Center in downtown Evansville, I'm David James, and this is 2 Main Street as we explore the lost treasures of Indiana. Favorite haunts of the past, restaurants, drive-in theaters, concert halls, businesses, even lost communities. Have you ever heard of Hindostan, the Horace A. Tuttle shipwreck, or Fort Le Petit? Each is a treasure, just waiting to be discovered and, I guess, rediscovered. Our travel guide is the author of Lost Treasures of Indiana, Joseph Peet, an award-winning journalist with the Times of Northwest Indiana, and the author of several books about his Hoosier home. So, Joseph Peet, welcome to 2 Main Street. Congratulations on the book.
Oh, thank you, and thank you so much for having me.
Well, Lost Treasures, these are gems, and I was always fascinated with this ghost town of Hindostan in southern Indiana. Used to be a kind of a prosperous stagecoach route, but folks just moved out, didn't they?
Oh, absolutely, yes. There was a British immigrant, Caleb Fellows, who had served with the East India Company, and that's why he named it Hindostan. But he came to Indiana when it was still a frontier. It was still the frontier, and it was being settled from the south up from the Ohio River, headed north, and he put his community on the East Fork of the White River. It was a big stagecoach route at the time between New Albany and Vincennes. That was a big form of travel. We just had a stagecoach in up here in Northwest Indiana that's being restored that was on the main stagecoach route between Detroit and St. Louis. So that was a very popular form of travel at the time. But many people were settling in like houseboats on the river. It was kind of prospering. It had 1,200 residents. It was the largest community in Davis County at the time. And then there was just an outbreak of disease that broke out. They don't know for sure what it was. It could have been yellow fever. It could have been cholera. But it ended up just ravaging the community. It killed roughly about half the population. And within literally decades, it was just completely abandoned. There's still the Hindostan Falls out there on the river. And there's a historical marker in the, you know, state fishing and recreation area. But it was just the town just ended up getting completely wiped out. There are rumors, like, for years after that there was, you know, buried gold there, that type of thing that some people would occasionally search for. But Indiana is actually littered with such communities. In the Indiana Dunes, for instance, there was, like, City West. They built several communities that ended up getting swallowed by sand dunes, and one of them was this grand city they envisioned that was going to rival Chicago, and the sand dunes were just whipped around by the winds, and they didn't realize they were moving, and it ended up, like, swallowing a lot of the homes. And
Hindostan Falls, still an attraction. It's right off the road there. People can check it out. Also, I had never heard of this one, Joe, the Horace Tuttle Shipwreck. What's that all about?
Oh, yes, absolutely. One of the things that's, like, little known is being on a Great Lakes state, that there used to be a huge amount of commercial shipping and wooden vessels in, like, the 1800s and going up to maybe, like, the very early 1900s at the dawn of the 20th century, but they would move things like timber from Michigan, or they would suck up a lot of sand from the bed of the, you know, Lake Michigan, and they would use it in construction projects to use it as an ingredient for concrete. And those types of things, they'd move glass and all kinds of different goods were moved along the Great Lakes. And there's over 3,000 different shipwrecks that are buried at the bottom of the Great Lakes, including just 100 just off the shore in Indiana. Two of the more famous ones are just off the Indiana State Park. There is there's the J.D. Marshall. It was the deadliest maritime tragedy in Indiana history. And then there was the a very famous one in Michigan City that's also an underwater nature preserve. But the Horace Tuttle is kind of a lesser known one, where it was like a bulk freighter that, you know, in the late 1800s, it moved a lot of agricultural products along the Great Lakes. And it's starting to get to be that time of year. There's the famous gales of November, if you've ever heard the wreck of the Edmund Fitzgerald.
Sure.
It's the time where the Great Lakes start to get really choppy. It's very dangerous. A lot of the shipping companies tend to put out the crews to get, like, they tend to rush them through as many of the last voyages as they can, because it's about to get to the point where the Great Lakes will freeze and it'll become innavigable and they won't be able to send out anymore. So the waters are, it's just a recipe for disaster, with the crews are being pressed to do more and more, and the waters are, you know, get more and more dangerous. But the Horace Tuttle ended up sinking just off of the coast of Michigan City. It was trying to get into the creek going into town, and it didn't make it. And the crew of 14 sailors all survived. There were the lifeguard and the life-saving station. They were able to rescue them all. But it was carrying a cargo of corn that, like, ended up getting mostly lost in Lake Michigan. Rescuers were able to salvage some of it, but the Michigan City residents would complain that the beach and the coastline smelled like a brewery for a long time, because the rotting corn was just there fermenting and rotting in the Lake Michigan, and it, you know, continued to wash up for years after the ship sank. The remains are still there. It's the Muskegon is another famous one that's right off the coast there in Michigan City. You could take scuba gear and go out and, you know, look at it, and it's preserved by the state as like an underwater nature preserve.
Another lost treasure you mentioned in your book, Le Petit Fort, the small fort.
Oh, absolutely. Yes, like if you visit like the Northeast or like New Jersey or New England, you know, you go around and you look at historic markers. There's all these historic markers talking about the Revolutionary War and this or that battle is fought there, and, you know, so on. And this is where they crossed the Delaware, and et cetera. But, you know, you don't really associate Indiana typically with the Revolutionary War. It was still, you know, the frontier back then. It wasn't, you know, yet a state at that point. Like you noted, it wasn't until 1816 that Indiana, you know, became a state. But there was actually a Revolutionary War battle in Indiana. There was what was called Le Petit Fort. It was at Lake Michigan and at Dunes Creek, which is a creek flowing into there. And they built the French had built a fur trading depot there at a very strategic location right by where the creek flows into Lake Michigan. And it ended up being seized by the British during the French and Indian War. And then the British kind of held on to it and used it as a small fort, because Petit Fort wasn't the formal name of it. It was actually more of a description. It just literally means the small fort in French. And then, but there was a team of, it was kind of seldom used, only used when needed. And there was a team of raiders from Illinois that decided they were going to rob a British fort in Southwest Michigan in Fort St. Joseph. And so they took, they went by river and portage. They took the Illinois, the Kankakee, the St. Joseph rivers. They traveled up there and they robbed this British fort. The British were very upset about it. They managed to round up a lot of like loyalists among the settlers and a lot of the Potawatomi Indians. And they put together sort of a posse and chased the raiders back toward Illinois. And they were chasing them across the Indiana Dunes. It was one of the, they were on foot at that point, and it was one of the, you know, going along the south shore of Lake Michigan was the easiest form of travel. They ended up getting kind of cornered by the time they got to Petit Fort, which was vacant at the time. And the British forces just had a huge numerical advantage, especially with the help of the Potawatomi and everything. And they were able, they kind of had their last stand in the Petit Fort. The British and the natives ended up killing four of them. They wounded two, and then they captured seven more. The area was very heavily wooded at the time, and there a few of them were able to escape into the woods. But it was not a huge battle or anything, but it was a historically noteworthy battle that took place. It did have kind of strategic significance, though, because it's blamed for slowing the Americans' efforts to capture Detroit, which was a very strategic point at that point. They thought it was key to controlling the Northwest Territory. So it did affect the efforts there. But a lot of people just don't associate Indiana with the Revolutionary War at all. And it's just interesting to uncover some of the military history.
Sure is. Le Petit Fort. Great history lesson there, Joseph. Now, we talked about Hindustan earlier, a ghost town. There's another lost community. This one, though, was never, ever populated. But there were thousands of tourists visiting Littleville. Tell me about Littleville.
Oh, absolutely. It's a very fascinating story, actually. There are similar towns across the country. There's like a tiny town in Colorado. It was a miniature town that was built in Chesterton by a steel worker named William Murray, and it was around the 1930s and 1940s. And at the time, rock gardening was like a national craze. Like a ton of people were into rock gardening. So it was the Great Depression. Times were tough. He was looking for ways to bring in other income, and he and his family started building like these miniature buildings that they were originally selling to use for the people could place out in rock gardens. Like some businesses would put them out as an attraction, and then they'd sell, you know, farm animals or eggs or what have you. And it was just a way of businesses would use to kind of stir up interest. And then they finally produced enough where they had the idea, well, why don't we just build a town ourselves? So they created what they dubbed Littleville. And it was like a full-blown town. It wasn't really meant to represent Chesterton per se, because they took a lot of liberties with it. It had like houses and baseball stadiums and schools and hotels and so forth. But they just put in like a ton of, there was a lighthouse, an oil refinery, a feed store, cemeteries, a movie theater. They built in a castle that was modeled after the famous Neuschwanstein in Germany that was also used to as an inspiration for Disney World. And then they built this like just a very elaborate, they spent hours putting together some of these. They put together this Gothic church where the choir would actually sing inside, and they spent over 300 hours putting it together. They built literally more than 125 buildings just with incredible detail. Like they would put cows in the pastures. They would light up the streetlights at night. There was like audio devices they would wire to it for sound. One of the more interesting ones too is they had a singing tower that would play music daily at noon, kind of like a Carillon or bell tower. They built an ocean liner that they called the Empress of the Lilliput from the Lilliputians from the famous novel. And then they had an amplifier on it and to play orchestral pieces for the tiny passengers on the dance floor on the ship's deck. And so they just incredible amount of detail went into it. It was a big attraction. It attracted, it was on the cover, it was featured in publications like Popular Science, Popular Mechanics. It was in newspapers all over the country. They were calling it like the world's biggest little village. They did like short films about it, but Paramount and scientific films. And it was just like, it was kind of a craze at the time. It did draw somewhere between like 50 and 100,000 visitors a year at peak, but it's doubtful that the family ever made much money from it because they only charged 5 cents to for admission. But it, like a little interesting details they had about it was that they had they actually printed a miniature newspaper as a souvenir, the Littleville News, that they charged like 2 cents for. With like, you know, updates about the buildings and so forth. They sold postcards, but they also had a miniature post office, sort of like the one in Santa Claus, where you could get it stamped for Santa Claus for Christmas time. They had it where
whatever happened to all these miniature buildings in Littleville?
Yeah, unfortunately, what happened is they used rubber a lot as one of the construction materials, and then when World War II rolled around, there were rubber shortages and rubber quotas that kind of capped the production. And then so they found it impossible to keep adding to it and to maintain it and to keep having fresh stuff so you draw new people. Because it drew people from like Austria and Japan and all over the world. But obviously the main source of business is going to be locally. So they weren't able to add to it or do anything with it or maintain what they had. And they ended up, closing it. And it just, a lot of it, there are a couple of buildings that are still in people's backyards. But a lot of it was just basically the area was turned into housing, and it's just now just a normal subdivision. And there are very few traces, unless you know where to look for, of the, you know, what had been this big national attraction.
Another lost treasure. Okay, let's talk about Pluto water, Joe. America's laxative. When nature won't, Pluto will.
This is a very fascinating one. They have the French Lick. The French Lick area was known for its mineral waters. The world famous like West Baden Springs Hotel is there. It was the largest dome in the entire world before they built the Houston Astrodome, and it, you know, one time drew people from all over. It brought in like the Yankees, the Cubs, teams like that would do kind of spring training in the area. but Hollywood stars would come in by train, and the big attraction was the mineral waters, which were reported to putatively have, like, healing powers. Pluto was one of the big national brands that emerged from there. It was high in sulfur. It was very high in sulfuric content, and it was kind of, they decided to market it as America's laxative, because apparently it would work in, like, as little as half an hour. It would be effective in its purpose. And some people also used it for other ailments, too. Like, Louis Armstrong's mother gave it to him repeatedly to help treat him for lockjaw. And it was just, but that at the time, like, you know, sodium, magnesium sulfate, a lot of those mineral salts were kind of considered cure-alls for different ailments. But then in 1971, they decided, the federal government deemed lithium to be a controlled substance. And since it had a high content of lithium salt, they ended up stopping the production of it. But it was interesting feature because it sort of had a devil as a mascot. It was actually supposed to be Pluto, the lord of the underworld, but it had very iconic advertising nationally. And it's been featured a lot in, popular culture. It's been mentioned by Kurt Vonnegut and Player Piano and Sanford and Sons. And it was like the main plot of So-Called the River, which was written by the great Bloomington author Michael Cortia, that was converted into like a horror film that was filmed there at the West Baden Springs Hotel. But it was it kind of captured the popular imagination at the time.
Now, another lost beverage that you talk about in your book, Lost Treasures of Indiana, El Frio. I've never heard about El Frio.
It was at the time, it was in Gary. It was in the Midtown Gary neighborhood. There is actually a mural on, there's Thomas Edison housing on West Fifth Street near the downtown, where it's been abandoned for a while, but it was originally designed by Thomas Edison as, like, worker housing, where it's, like, cast-in-place concrete method. And they're trying to, like, save some of it through historic preservation. And one of the main murals they put on there was of, you know, to celebrate the El Frio beverage company. It ended up becoming, like, one of the largest black-owned pop manufacturers in the United States. They made several different sodas, like a lemon lime, cola, you know, different ones. It was the local franchisee that made Joe Louis Punch back when that was the soft drinks that the Boxer had, Cadillac sodas. There was, it was mainly kind of distributed in the Chicago area, Northwest Indiana, but it was founded by a Mississippi native. He ended up growing it to, growing it to a much larger location. It was, you know, for decades, it kind of was a big, major soda supplier in the area. But it ended up dissolving. He ended up serving, there was Richard Hatcher, who was elected mayor, and he ended up serving under the Hatcher administration and kind of, like, leaving the private sector. And then it just, without him, it kind of ended up withering away. But it was, you can still see the, they still have a lot of the bottles in, like, antique stores and that type of thing.
My guest is Joseph Pete. He's the author of Lost Treasures of Indiana. Coming up, we're going to learn more.
Welcome
about
back to Two Main Street. I'm David James.
Our treasure hunt. Joseph Pete.
I'm David James.
Of Lost
Two Main Street.
We'll be
right back.
That includes businesses, entertainment venues, food and drink, and sports teams. Now, before we go on, Joseph, there's a dedication in your book to your late brother Tom. Tell me about Tom.
Oh yes, yeah, no, we were very close. I grew up with three brothers in Northwest Indiana, and he was, and he went out to Hollywood and lived in Los Angeles, and he was an extra in a lot of films. He was in, like, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood and The Irishman. He never really got that many speaking roles, but he ended up working as just an extra in a lot of, he was on screen in a lot of different prominent Hollywood movies, but he unfortunately had passed away a year ago at this point. And he was just a very, far too young, just a bright light. He was very, he was always like the class clown in school. He always was known for cracking people up. He was just a very wry sense of humor, very amusing, and we just all miss him very deeply. And unfortunately, the book had to be dedicated to him under those circumstances, but he was very much loved.
Can you tell me how Tom died?
He was working at the Comic-Con in San Diego, and he just had like passed out and then hit his head when he fell on the sidewalk.
Oh my. Okay. Now you started your career, long career in journalism. Where did you get started, writing?
Oh, absolutely. Well, I've been writing since I was a kid. I was just always very bookish. I've been a lifelong bibliophile. I'm the kind of person who brings like books into movie theaters. I just always have a book by my side. I've always been holed up in like libraries or bookstores or that type of thing. And you know, I wanted to be a novelist, but you know, other than Stephen King, very few people make a living doing that. So I ended up going into newspapers. Not exactly the most, you know, thriving, you know, lucrative profession, but it's a way you can write, you know, on a daily basis and kind of exercise those muscles. And that's, you know, what I ended up getting into. I was in, I studied at Indiana University and did, worked at the Indiana Daily Student there. I worked at my high school newspaper as well, but I ended up becoming a journalist. I worked in the Indianapolis suburbs and I went back home to where I'm from in Northwest Indiana. And I've been a columnist and a business reporter there for over a decade now.
Now, you've written other books. Seems like you're kind of the Chamber of Commerce for Northwestern Indiana. A lot of books about the region.
Oh, yes. It's a mixture. Most of my books are kind of history focused, but I've also written a couple of travelogues. And one that really, but Lost Hammond, Indiana, and Lost East Chicago, Indiana, they're kind of looks at the industrial cities. Like Hammond had one of the early NFL teams. East Chicago, like Michael Jordan played his first game in a gym, in an old Washington High School gym. It kind of covers interesting points of history about those two kind of Rust Belt cities along like Michigan. And then I wrote 100 Things to Do in Northwest Indiana Before You Die, kind of a bucket list travelogue to the area. There hadn't been one published in like 20 years. So after I was published with the History Press, I reached out to Reedy about doing that. I kind of always had that on the had hoped to do that. And then I wrote Secret Northwest Indiana, which is kind of a mixture of history and travelogue. It looks at like kind of more of off the beaten path type attractions, but like a lot of the history, like a lot of the shipwreck sites it looks at, submarine experiments in like Michigan. There were early, there was an inventor who would take his family out on submarine journeys near Michigan City, near the lighthouse, and tried unsuccessfully to sell it to the U.S. Navy. It was kind of considered a death trap. They, in fact, thought when there was they discovered the full killer submarine at the bottom of the Chicago River, they had thought that it was his that had sunk and he had died that way. But it turned out to be someone else. But it just kind of off the beaten path stuff like that, like the Nike missile silos that they used to have to during the Cold War in case it ever escalated, and you know, just unusual kind of strange places.
Okay, I got this question for you. Now, on your Facebook page, you say you're a circus raffle calculator winner. What's that?
Oh, yes. Oh, I just tried to. That's just kind of a joke I throw in there for levity, because a lot of those author bios will tend to tout like, oh, this or that, or you know, won this or that award, or you know, or lives part time between Los Angeles and Cape Cod, or you know, to things like that. So I just tried to insert something where it's a little self-deprecating.
Okay.
Where, like, I had the Hammond Civic Center is a local venue where the Barnum and Bailey Circus and different circuses would come through. And then I did actually at one point win a calculator in a raffle there, but I was kind of using that to kind of poke fun at some of the more self-important author bios. And then you know, something a little more lighthearted, I guess.
Let's go back to some of those lost treasures in the book. Tell me about the Clabber Girl of Terre Haute.
There was a museum. There was the Clabber Girl Museum. The Clabber Girl, of course, was like one of the big, the baking powder brand was one of the, you know, Indiana's produced a lot of successful national brands like Burger Chef and companies that have kind of, Wonder Bread would be another big one, but a lot of companies that have reached, you know, become kind of like national icons. But mm-hmm. Clabber Girl baking soda powder is definitely one of the, and baking soda and cornstarch are definitely some of the bigger ones. But the Clabber Girl company, owned by Holman's, who also do the Speedway and the IndyCar Racing League, they had a museum for years where to kind of honor the history of Clabber Girl. It was really the only baking museum in the country, I believe. And it was run outside of the corporate headquarters in Terre Haute until they ended up shutting it down in 2022. I think the pandemic kind of hurt some of the visitation. But they had like a demonstration kitchen. They had a replica grocery store. a Victorian parlor, a saloon. There was also like a racing exhibit kind of illustrating how the Holmans, you know, were involved with motorsports for a long time and the Motor Speedway. And then, but it had a bake shop, a cafe. They sold, of course, sold Clabber Girl products, things of that nature. The book looks a lot like that at the Bygone Museums, like the College Football Hall of Fame that was in South Bend before moving to Georgia, or the old Lincoln Museum that was in Fort Wayne when the Lincoln Insurance Company was still there before it consolidated to Philadelphia, and different, you know, Bygone Museums like that. There was a Dillinger Museum in Crown Point that paid tribute to, or not paid tribute, but like chronicled the infamous exploits of the Great Depression era bank robber. There were a lot of locations like that or museums like that just kind of faded from the scene.
Now, if people love nostalgia, they're going to love this book because you tackle a lot of places across the Hoosier State, some lost attractions, the Hoosier Slide, Blake Gardens, Circle Park, Pogue's Run, Howard County's Sycamore Tree, and you're an Indiana University graduate. There was a place called Bear's Place. Was that a hangout at IU?
I ended up doing a lot of IU stuff. It just kind of made me nostalgic. There was one I kind of regret not including was Yogi's, but it was kind of too similar to Bear's Place, so I didn't want to keep doing the same one over and over again. But Bear's Place was a very popular kind of off-campus hangout for more than half a century. It was on the it was near kind of the music school on the side of campus. It was, you know, typical kind of college place, like burgers, wings, craft beer, etc. They would have music, but they were particularly known for their almost world famous Harry Bears, which were these massive 32-ounce drinks that were sweetened so you couldn't detect the alcohol, like the popular, like the punch or that type of thing. But it was more than just like a place where college kids would go to imbibe. But, you know, it was kind of a cultural hub. They would have it was a jazz club for a long time. It was right down the street from the School of Music. They would have, like, a lot of the jazz professors would come over and perform there. They would have later, like, some indie and alternative rock bands were there. But the Ryder film series, that was a very famous series that showed, like, independent films locally. They did a lot of their screenings there. So it's kind of a cultural hub as well. But the IU Foundation ended up buying it, and it was just, like, one of those very popular hangout spots people would have a lot of fond memories of. But I included a lot of places like that, like the Von Lee Theater or Plaid 9 Cinema, which was they also specialized in indie movies. And they had this hilarious sign by the counter where it was, VHS is totally due for a comeback any day now. And, you know, places, the cinema had a lot of Irish Lion, a lot of places like that. Definitely anyone who went to IU and also Purdue and other schools will find stuff that they'll remember from their campus days.
Of course, a lot of our listeners will remember some bygone restaurants, Sir Beef, Burger Chef, very popular in this area, but long gone now.
Yes. I wrote about a lot of the chains, like the, Sir Beef, for instance, where they would do the, it was similar to like Rack's Roast Beef or Arby's, but they did the, you know, were known for their beef sandwiches and also kosher corned beef. They had a Sir Ham with the
Sir Ham. I remember Sir Ham. Yeah. And Grandy's, of course, was very popular down here too.
Oh, absolutely. Yes. Yeah. The
COVID, yeah, I think COVID kind of closed them down, didn't it?
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. The chain of diners that they had with people might remember the cinnamon rolls or the country fried steak or the, you know, biscuits or, you know, mashed potatoes, the traditional kind of American fare. It really looks like that. It was, you know, all across the tri-state too, also across the river in Kentucky. But yeah, it was one of those that, unfortunately, the pandemic was really hard for a lot of, a shocking amount of the restaurants were like fairly recent vintage, because a lot just never recovered from the shock of the pandemic.
Butt Drugs, free parking in the rear. I still have one of their coffee mugs. Cord and Business, now closed.
Yes, yeah, that one was notable. That one, well, it got national attention because they did there was a popular YouTube podcast that did a commercial for it that went viral like maybe 10 or 20 years ago, where they ended up on like Howard Stern and all these, all these media outlets nationally, where, you know, they did the jokes about the free parking in the rear and things of that nature. But It was, of course, somebody's surname, but it was just an amusing, the phrasing of it was just amusing. But it was, it survived for like three generations. It was, of course, a pharmacy for a long time, but eventually morphed into almost more of a department store. And they sold a lot of like their own merchandise, like I Love Butt Drugs and everything. But they, it had the old time soda fountain that was, you know, a big draw to it. Like the, a lot of those, you know, where you could get phosphates or that type of thing. It's not rarely around anymore, but it was moved over to the 1819 General Store in Elizabeth. But the, you know, kind of captured the national imagination for a while. It was on the Ellen DeGeneres Show. It was Red and Link did the kind of a free commercial for it. And it just, you know, they were able to sell like all kinds of fanny packs and other memorabilia online. All those things, people all across the country.
L.S. Ayers and Company. There used to be a big Ayers department store in Evansville at Washington Square Mall. And, of course, that's no longer here either.
Oh, yes. Yeah, that was a big, that was a national chain that emerged from Indianapolis. But unfortunately, you see that, like, that with the department store business, it's been extremely rough. Like, a lot of the, it used to be back in the day, like, every, like, Pittsburgh or Youngstown, Ohio, or every city would have, like, their own department store chain, but a lot of those ended up being consolidated by, you know, Macy's or Van Mao or some of the other bigger brands over the years. And now most of them are struggling and struggling to survive. But L.S. Ayers was very well known, like both downtown Indianapolis and across the state. It was, you know, it was famous for the ads like that Ayers look and so forth. But they were, you know, they had that tea room where it was a loss leader. But it was like a must visit, like once a year, usually on Christmas, because they decorate really nicely for Christmas. They would put a chair up above the decorative clock in downtown Indy, and they would. But they, you know, they had the chicken pot pie and the chicken velvet soup, and just some real decadent meals. They have a replica of it in the Indiana State Museum, where people can go and you know, try and sample it for nostalgia's sake. But they built these; they had grand department stores not only in downtown Indianapolis, but all across the. You know, all across the Midwest. But it, they were also, their impact is kind of still felt today. They were, where the Circle Center Mall is now, they're one of the, you know, buildings in there that was preserved. But one thing that they did is when the downtown Indianapolis started to decline in the 1970s, is they were one of the people who first started investing heavily in trying to bring in hotels and trying to boost the convention business. And L.S. Ayers didn't end up making it, but the, it helped kind of position Indianapolis as this big hub of, you know, for conventions and tour, sports tourism especially. But, you know, where today they bring in like events like Gen Con and the FFA, and they bring in tens of thousands of people a year. And that really, if it weren't for, you know, L.S. Ayers or some other like business leaders, that never would have come about. But it was, a lot of people just fondly remember it because it was just the grand department store where people just went to for the latest fashions. And yeah, they grew all across, they were in Glenbrook Square in Fort Wayne. They grew all across, you know, Louisville. They were all across the area.
My guest is Joseph Peet. He's the author of Lost Treasures of Indiana, published by Reedy Press. So you had a lot of spots in the book. I'm sure some didn't make it. How did you decide what locations to keep and what to discard?
There were a couple factors. Well, one is I've written four books previously. They kind of focus more on the Northwest Indiana area, but I tried to avoid repeating anything I had previously written too much about. So like the Muskegon shipwreck we talked about earlier, for instance, I didn't include that just so people who have read my previous books wouldn't, you know, see me recycling the same material, that type of thing. But this one was statewide. So I've lived all over the state. I've lived all over the state. I've traveled to pretty much everywhere. I've been to, you know, most of the museums, you know, I've taken time to visit, you know, even smaller cities like Seymour, you know, places like that, you know, Edinburgh, places, you know, kind of off the beaten path places. So I'm kind of familiar with the layout to begin with and a lot of the prominent things that were lost. But a big thing with this one is I didn't want to make sure I was omitting anything like too significant. Mm-hmm. So I reached out to almost all of the major historical societies and like libraries across the state. And then, you know, surveyed them on what they thought were notable places from their areas to make sure I didn't have any too glaring omissions. Because a lot of it, I tried to do stuff of more recent vintage that would make people nostalgia, that they'd have memories of, like Sir Beef or Grandy's. But then I also wanted to include places that were, like, historically notable, like Tomlinson Hall in Indianapolis or the Pembroke Arcade, which were very significant for their era. But the people who remember them are long dead at this point. So I kind of tried to get a mix of, you know, things that were historically notable, but also ones that were, you know, that would, you know, kind of infuse people with like warm feelings and nostalgia. And then also a major consideration was geographic mix, because a lot of the state is very, you know, it's, we're one state, but there's a lot of difference between like Fort Wayne and, you know, Columbus. You know, there's every place has like its own local flavor. And so I tried to make sure every area of the state was pretty well represented, and that I would have, you know, a lot from Terre Haute and Anderson and Muncie and South Bend, and, you know, just kind of try to include New Albany and, you know, all corners of Indiana, and make sure I didn't have any kind of just egregious omissions. So there were, of course, like, they had limitations. It's only, you know, 200 words. They don't let you go infinitely. So I wasn't able to, like, include every single thing I would have liked to. Like, there were more, like, record labels or that kind of thing. But some of it also was, like, repetition. Like, Yogi's was another beloved place in Bloomington, but it was kind of too close to some of the other ones. So I didn't want to keep, like, with similar entries, hitting that over and over again. So it was just kind of like a balancing act, I guess.
Well, we've got much more to talk about. We got these lost sports teams in Indiana, the Fort Wayne Pistons. Remember those guys? And the cars that used to be made in Indiana, the Duesenberg, the Studebaker, all kinds of stuff to talk about. More Indiana treasures to come. Stay with us. This is 2 Main Street on WNIN-FM. We'll be right back. Welcome back to 2 Main Street. I'm David James. If you are just joining us, my guest is Joseph Peet, author of Lost Treasures of Indiana, published by Reedy Press. Now, here's some great questions here. Where did Elvis play his final concert in Indiana?
Oh, absolutely. Oh, well, it was his final concert, period, though. It was very historically significant. Market Square Arena in Indianapolis, which was the... probably most famous is where the Pacers originally played, dating back to when they were still an ABA team that was squaring off against, you know, teams like the Kentucky Colonels and the Spirits of St. Louis and so forth. He last performed his last concert anywhere in 1977 in Indianapolis, and there's still a historic marker there at the 17,000 square foot venue. It was, of course, a big place for. It was replaced by the what's now called the Gainbridge Field House, and it's gone through different names.
And Hoosier Dome over the years. Hoosier Dome is also gone.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. Well, that an interesting note about that one too was the that helped lure the Colts from Baltimore originally when they built it. It was necessary to build it. It was one of the largest AstroTurf enclosed domes in the time, similar to the Metro Dome and the Silver Dome. But that one was, they were still paying for that up until, they were still paying that for years after it was demolished in 2008. It was the debt on that they were still servicing for years and years after, long after the Lucas Oil Stadium replaced it as the main football stadium in town.
Now, I didn't know that Wolfgang Puck, the famous chef and entrepreneur, started his cooking career in downtown Indianapolis.
Oh, absolutely, yes. Yeah, it was his first American cooking job. He worked at a French restaurant called Le Tour, which was at the top of the Indiana National Bank building. It was more than, you know, you have a lot of those restaurants with, like, the rotating restaurants or where they're kind of gimmicky and they appeal to tourists and that kind of thing. But this was actually a legitimate fine dining restaurant that happened to be at the top of, like, a skyscraper. Indy had the Eagle's Nest at the Hyatt Regency, the Carousel at the Hilton. But this one was on the 35th floor of the 37th building. You could have, you know, panoramic views of the city and the skyline. It was it specialized in kind of haute French cuisine in the traditional fashion. It was still extremely popular at that time when he started there in the 70s. You know, Julia Child was on TV all the time. It was still very much in fashion. But it was he worked for there a couple of years and before he set out to Los Angeles and then. You know, started Spago and kind of revolutionized gourmet pizza and became like one of the first big celebrity chefs. And it eventually was closed in 1992. It kind of went on for years without him, but there are a lot of people like that, like Hank Aaron or Wayne Gretzky, or a lot of people started their careers in Indiana before going on to really change history.
Well, if you couldn't afford to go to Le Tour, you could go to the Frankenstein fast food joint. Is that in Etna, outside Gary?
Oh, yes. It was in Gary. It was kind of, depending on how you define it, it was near the Aetna or the Miller subdivision or the Miller neighborhoods. But it was definitely a very iconic restaurant. They're actually trying to rebuild the Frankenstein now. It was kind of based on a pun. They called it Frank-N-Stein, meaning Frank and Rupierstein, and they built a 20-foot-tall fiberglass Frankenstein monster with a giant hot dog in one hand and a giant Stein of root beer in another. And it was kind of it was like a hot dog and root beer joint. You went in, you parked there in the drive-in, and they would come to you and bring your few food. Very much in fashion at the time. They got sued by Universal Studios, which, did the Universal Monsters over copyright infringement. So what they did was they agreed to try to make it more representative of Mary Shelley's novel and not the movies. So they cut off the neck bolts. They removed the scar from the forehead. They changed the flesh from green to a more flesh color. When they started it in like the 60s, and they were originally planning to make it this big national chain, but it never took off for whatever reason. It was it might have partly had to do with the legal difficulties. There were they did open a cup. There were a couple though. There was one in South Carolina that actually like outlasted the original one in Gary, but it was a very popular diner for generations. And then when there was a big mystery recently too of what happened to the Frankenstein monster after it, after the restaurant closed, because it got, got taken down and removed. And then it just turned out that they gave it to like an employee, and he had, it ended up getting weathered over time, and they ended up destroying it in the woods. But it was just an interesting mystery that they're enthusiasts of the, what they call the roadside giants of back in the era where they would use like ads like that in Barbasol, they would do the roadside advertising with like giant statues for, like Mr. Bendo or Muffler Men or things like that. And there's a lot of that. There's its own kind of statues like that have their own kind of following.
Now, of course, a lost Indiana sports team, the Fort Wayne Pistons, very popular at one point in the NBA history.
Oh, absolutely. Yes, they were actually the Detroit Pistons of today got their start in Fort Wayne. And they were in Fort Wayne for a few decades. One thing a lot of people don't realize now is there's so much big money in, the NBA or NFL. A lot of these leagues actually got their start in like smaller Midwestern towns. Like Hammond had an NFL team. George Halas started, and the first black quarterback, Fritz Pollard, played there. But Fort Wayne is Fort Wayne was home to several different professional teams: the Eagles, the Falcons, the Vagabond Kings. The original team was sponsored by the Zellner Corporation. That's where the Piston names comes from. They made pistons for car engines. Fort Wayne is, of course, even to this day, it's not that far from Detroit. It's kind of a big automotive manufacturing town. But they had sponsored the Pistons during their Fort Wayne years for the first few decades. They ended up winning, actually, two national titles in 1944 and 1945. They ended up losing it. It's very topical, actually, too, because they lost to the Syracuse Nationals in the finals in 1955, and they were accused of shaving points for gamblers. So, like, all the big headlines recently of the big gambling scandal, like, all this stuff kind of happened before, and it's just kind of cyclical. But, it's coming back now. But by 1957, the team was kind of damaged the reputation by the scandal. The owner decided it was kind of too small a market, so they decided at that time they were going to relocate to Detroit. At that point, it was still the fifth largest city in the country. It's still the second largest metro area in the Midwest, but they moved it. They moved the team to Detroit, and they've of course had they had the bad boy team in the 80s that won all those titles. It's kind of one of the iconic franchises of the NBA. But a lot of the teams people realize don't hopped around a lot. Like the Lakers, obviously, there are no lakes in Los Angeles. It started out in Minnesota. They ended up they actually started out in Detroit and then Minnesota, and then so a lot of these franchises, the team people forever associate with the city actually hopped around quite a bit in the early days. But, the Pacers are not the only NBA team that called Indiana home.
Now, we can't end this conversation without talking about the lost Indiana automaker, Studebaker.
Yeah, there are quite a few. Indiana is one of the big, speaking of Detroit, too, Indiana in the early days, there was not a given that Detroit would end up being the auto city. There are a lot of auto manufacturers all around the country. Indiana was home to many of them. At the time, you had many people and many carriage makers and many, bicycle makers, and everybody was trying to get an auto. It was the next big thing. Indiana was home to multiple fledgling automakers in the early days. There was Studebaker, Stutz, Auburn, Duesenberg, Marmon, and a lot of the innovations in the industry came out of Indiana too. Like Indiana made the world's first sports car, rear mirrors, rubber tires. A lot of the stuff that we take for granted today with cars were actually developed in Indiana. But that's one focus of the book too, is like all the innovations Indiana came up with and the impact it had on the world. But the, you know, one of the better known ones was Studebaker, because it lasted up until the almost, it made it almost until the 70s. Their major one in South Bend, and they, you know, they made some pretty iconic automobiles that were, you know, purchased by the middle class all across the country. They were one that had transitioned. They started out doing wagon making, but they made the Rockne, the Champion, the Lark, the Starlighter, the Avanti. If you're ever up in South Bend, too, they have an excellent Studebaker Museum that kind of chronicles the history of it. It's very fascinating. But you had ones like the Stutz in Indianapolis, where they built, the Bearcat race car. And they put it together in under 5 weeks, and it was nicknamed the car that made good in a day. And it ended up winning. It was second in the 24 Hours of Le Mans race in France. And, you know, they were one of the some of the best performances in the Indianapolis 500 in the early days. But you had, you know, also luxury cars that were made in Indiana. The Auburn made some of the fanciest cars at the time. They would run ads saying, oh, 100 miles per hour or more certified and 150 horsepower. But they made roadsters, and you know, they ended up getting killed off by the Great Depression because their cars were too expensive for the market at the time, and they had to diversify into, you know, making appliances, sinks, kitchen cabinets. They even made Jeep bodies during World War II, but they ended up getting completely out of, the automotive business. But Duesenberg was another one where they made some of the most luxurious automobiles of the day that were driven by like movie stars like Clark Gable and Gary Cooper. And it was the height of elegance. They actually started out in St. Paul, Minnesota, but Eddie Rickenbacker from the Indianapolis Motor Speedway ended up helping move them to Indianapolis, and they, you know, they made race cars, and they made some of the, you know, high-end luxury models. But Indiana was just we're still a huge automotive manufacturing state. We've got Honda, Toyota, you know, GM, plants all. I think we're second or third most cars manufactured nationally. You know, obviously Michigan's up there, but we're right up there in that tier with Ohio and Kentucky, and as one of the biggest manufacturers of cars still in the country. But like in the early days, you know, we were very pioneering and came up with some of like the earliest car designs when it was kind of before the industry ended up kind of getting consolidated to the big three in Detroit. And now, of course, it's spread throughout a lot of the Ford manufacturers now plants all across the South, and it's a lot more spread out and, you know, than it was. But we were kind of a cradle of the auto industry in the early days.
So what's next for you?
Oh, it looks like I'm probably doing a local history book. My other publisher, the History Press, was interested in doing one on Lost Crown Point. That one also have like a lot of the Dillinger things, because that's where Dillinger had infamously escaped from the old Lake County Jail. The sheriff, Lillian Hawley, had threatened to put a bullet in his head herself if she ever caught him. That's what she previously told Life magazine. And it had kind of a rich, more than that, but it had kind of a rich gangland history too, where one of Al Capone's hitmen was arrested there after shooting someone in a bar and things of that nature. But it's the county seat of Lake County, and it's got a significant history dating back to the 19th century.
Now, there is nostalgia on every page of Lost Treasures of Indiana, some 200 pages, highly illustrated. It's a great read. I couldn't even talk about, we didn't get to these other topics, the John Dillinger Museum, the Mascot Hall of Fame, Pines Peak, the Circus Capital of the World, Little Nashville Opry, VJ Records, the Enchanted Forest, Rose Island, the list goes on and on. It's a great read. Author Joseph Peet, thanks for sharing these treasures on 2 Main Street. We really enjoyed the conversation.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
There are lost treasures of Indiana close to home. The book mentions the Evansville Shipyard, opened from 1942 to 1946, where a huge workforce built 167 landing ship tanks, LSTs, during World War II. Evansville's Pie Pan is also in the book, opening in 1978 and closing in 2024. Apple, cherry, pumpkin, and pecan among the favorites. Of course, even better with a scoop of ice cream. Another lost treasure, the monkey ship at Evansville's Mesker Park Zoo. The concrete replica of Christopher Columbus's ship, the Santa Maria, was a playground for macaques, capuchins, and lemurs. A lost landmark in Evansville is also featured in the book, Lost Treasures of Indiana, the Louisville and Nashville Union Depot. The Fulton Avenue station opened in 1902. The last train left the station in 1971, and the building came down in 1985. And one of the city's first churches is also just a footnote in the local history books, Assumption Catholic Church, dated back to 1836 and moved from 2nd and Sycamore to a lot across from the old Central High School, which is also gone. Assumption Church met its fate with a wrecking ball to make way for the Civic Center complex. Of course, with any book with a list, there are names and places that don't make the cut, and that opens the door for another book and another chapter. I'm David James, and this is 2 Main Street on your public radio station, WNIN-FM. To Main Street on WNIN-FM airs Thursday at noon and Saturday at 11. Previous shows are on demand at WNIN.org.